Hi, this is the Bits and Gigs podcast, where we relive the years of Gigmas past. I'm your usual host, Jamie, and today I'm joined by Nick of the After Dark Podcast Network. How's it going, Nick?
It's great. Thank you very much for having me on, Jamie.
It's okay. Like I said, you're part of the After Dark Podcast Network, which we're a part of. Do you want to plug any of your, because I know that you do...
Yeah, far too many podcasts. I'm kind of a bit of a niche-y kind of person, so a lot of the stuff that I do revolves around Disney and theme parks. So I do a very generic kind of encompassing Disney podcast called Disney Parks and Beyond, where we talk about the Disney parks and beyond that. And Discover DLP, which I know that you're a keen listener to, and is focused more on Disneyland Paris, which, you know, some people only like that or only know that, so that gets quite specialist. But we also do one about Universal theme parks called That Universal Podcast. And finally, the last one I'm going to plug is my short-lived Disney interview podcast I do with celebrities called This Is Your Life / My Disney Life, which we'll hopefully be coming back with new episodes in, what month are we in now? April? June. Let's say June. Because it's never when you want it to be, so let's say June. But you can hear me a lot of places and you will get sick of my voice.
I think I might hold you that to that June, actually, on the This Is Your Life, because I enjoy that one. So if it's not back by June, just like I do with the Discover DLP, if it gets too long on the Discover DLP, you start getting, seeing the tweets come in going, come on, guys, where's the episode? Come on.
You know what? The problem with that, so with a lot of with some of the podcasts, they are very consistent, and you know, bi-weekly normally, or That Universal Podcast is once a month, but it has set times. Discover DLP, because it's just me and my co-host Paul that does that, there's not a proper schedule. We always say, oh, we'll try and record it around the 15th of the month, but sometimes it doesn't happen, and if the other person doesn't nudge someone, then it doesn't happen, and so we have to wait basically for someone like yourself to go, there's not been a new podcast for a while, what's going on? And you go, oh yeah, we better get on that. So no, thank you for nudging us in the right direction.
I might just have to get myself on it as a manager or something like that, just to say I'm part of it.
Your podcast contribution to this network is completely sufficient, but if you do want to apply for that role, then we will put up a job advert soon that you can apply for.
Is it paid for?
Like everything on this network, no. You know.
No worries. So today we're going to be talking about your concert at the O2 Arena during Prince's residency in 2007. For anyone who's lived under a rock for the past 40 years, would it be? What year are we in now?
He kind of started in the late 70s. So, yeah, I suppose just over 40 years ago now.
Yeah. For anyone who's lived under a rock for the past 40 years, Prince Rogers Nelson, formerly known as Prince, was an American singer-songwriter, record producer, dancer, actor, director, multi-instrumentalist, you name it, he did it. Right, he was widely regarded as one of the greatest musicians of his generation. Think an amazing pop star across with Jimi Hendrix. He was well known for his guitar virtuoso and his high-pitched screams and falsetto vocals. So early on, he was known as Prince, and then in the midst of a contractual dispute in 1993, he changed his name to an unpronounceable symbol, which is now known as the love symbol, which, if you've ever seen it, if you haven't seen this, pause this podcast, go and have a look, Google the love symbol, come back, you'll know what it is. And at that time, he was sometimes known as the artist, formerly known as Prince, Taff Cap, or simply the artist. He's released hundreds and hundreds of songs under his name and multiple names under his life and written, I believe the estimate is around 500 to well over 1,000 songs for other artists, including hits such as Nothing Compares to You, Sinead O'Connor, and Manic Monday by the Bangles. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2016, the age of 57, with an overdose at his flat in Paisley Park. But we won't get bogged down on that because, you know, his life should be remembered as being an amazing musician. He was a Grammy Award winner, Billboard Icon Award, Academy Award, Golden Globe Award, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Just a legend. So let's go back right to before you got all these accolades. Do you want to tell us how you were when you first heard Prince and how you got into him, Nick?
You know what? It's I was trying to rack my brains around this because listening to some of your other podcast episodes, I know it's a question that you ask your guests all the time. I was trying to think, where did I first hear about Prince? And I actually think it was 1989 and it was Bat Dance. That was the first time that I kind of saw Prince. And I must have heard some of his music before because, you know, during the 80s, you know, is probably his most popular period in terms of, you know, success, chart success. So I must have heard songs at discos and stuff like that, but didn't know who he was. And then I remember seeing a video for Bat Dance, which was from the Tim Burton Batman film of that same year. And it's, if you've never seen it, it's quite the video. It's a very special video. And it was just, it sounded like really weird. Didn't sound like anything I'd ever heard before. Bat Dance and the whole Batman soundtrack he did is quite out there.
Which Batman is this now? Is this Michael Keaton? Is it?
This is the first Batman, Michael Keaton, 1989. And so there was two albums released on the film. One was the Danny Elfman score, and the other one was this album by Prince. And I can't remember exactly why. I think it must have been something to do with the contract he had with Warner's, where basically he had to record so many soundtrack albums or something. But he ended up doing this whole album about the Batman film. And as I said, it's not his finest hour by any stretch, but there's a few good songs on there. But yeah, Bat Dance was obviously huge that summer because the Batman film was huge that summer. This predates you, right? I know this from knowing how old you are. So I don't know if you've ever, I don't know how much you know about how big a pop culture phenomenon Batman was that year, but it was the first film that felt like a cultural event in my lifetime. And if, I mean, I think people still look back at it now as being like a kind of watershed moment, because even with things like Star Wars, I mean, the first Star Wars came out of the blue and no one knew anything about it. So there was not much fanfare, but obviously the other ones were more popular. But with Batman, the marketing blitz started like a year out. Like the first trailer was shown over a year before the film was coming out. And that's when the marketing kind of started. And that logo, I mean, the film poster was just, apologies, that's a Tamagotchi. This is what happens when you live with kids. The marketing was huge. And that Batman logo was on literally everything. You could not go into a shop and not see Batman merchandise. It was everywhere on every kind of product imaginable. Kids t-shirts, adult t-shirts, action figures, lunch boxes. You know, you name it, it was there. You could not move from Batman. It was incredible.
Sorry, just as a side swipe away from the music there, it's strange is that you talk about that kind of marketing and stuff like that for that movie, because nowadays that's the norm. You know, you look at the Avengers and stuff. The Avengers, you know what's happening in the Avengers a year before the Avengers has come out. So, like, to have that back then, it just seems crazy.
And you've got to remember as well that we didn't have the internet. Like, the internet wasn't around in 1989. You know, I was six. The internet was just being born. So I was the perfect age for this because, well, actually, it turned out I wasn't, because the film was the first ever 12-rated film in the UK. So I couldn't even go and see it at the cinema. But you know, the only way you found out about it was through newspapers, magazines, billboard posters, bus stop posters, sticker albums. And so, like, the toys were everywhere as well. So you were becoming aware that this was a thing. But, you know, at that time, the only Batman I knew about was the 66 Adam West version. That's what we had on TV. That's all we had. So that's the only Batman I knew. I didn't even know there was comics. And then you had this. So even now, like, you're right about the Avengers, but if you think what the Avengers is like now when a new film is coming out, times that by about 5 or 10, and you'll get what Batman was. And the really weird thing was that then kind of kickstarted like a kind of revolution in how to advertise films. And Disney did the exact same thing a year later with Dick Tracy, and it did nowhere near as well. So just because you market the hell out of everything doesn't actually guarantee success. Maybe it didn't have a Prince album. It had a Madonna album. It didn't have a Prince album. Maybe that was the difference. But
don't be going in bad mouth with Dick Tracy now. We can't be able
I'm glad to hear that, because I'm a huge defender of Dick Tracy, and I'm normally quite alone in that battle. So I'm glad to meet a fellow brother. But yeah, I mean, this stuff was incredible, and I've never seen it since. The closest I've seen to something like that was probably not even Avengers, but like The Force Awakens, because it was the first Star Wars film in so long. But even that paled in comparison to the summer of '89. Completely dominated by one thing and one thing only, and that was Batman. So this Prince album that came out that summer was huge. It was everywhere. There was a program on ITV called the Chart Show. So, you know, we're Top of the Pops back then, and then ITV had the Chart Show, but the Chart Show just played music videos, and that's where I first saw Prince and the Bat Dance video, and I was like, this guy is something kind of special. And then because I knew who he was, I would then kind of like recognize songs on the radio. And then I would see some of his albums. And then it was around about the time, so you mentioned 1993, didn't you? As when he changed his name to The Symbol.
Yes, yeah.
The artist formerly known as. So he released an album in 1994 called The Gold Experience, I want to say. I think it was 94.
The Black Album was 94. The Gold Experience was 95.
95. Well, it's close. Considering I'm not read up on this, that wasn't too bad. and the not the lead single from that, but one of the singles on that was Gold. And it didn't chart very high, if I remember rightly. It might have scraped the top 10, maybe the top 20. But that song like felt like an anthem, and I was like, okay, this guy is kind of like serious. But it wasn't really until I got to about 1920 when I really kind of went back and started looking into Prince properly and picking up a few albums and stuff like that, and just realizing what an incredible artist he is. And I can't even say, because I'm not like a diehard Prince fan. I am a fan of Prince and I like his music, but you know, I've got a friend who's a tribute act to Prince and saw him, you know, 20, 30 times, if not more, over the years. He's slightly older than me, so obviously he had more chances to go and see him. But the tour that we're going to talk about in a minute, he went to, I think, 6 of those gigs.
Jesus.
At that residency, right? So, you know, Prince has real diehard fans. So I'm not going to pretend that I'm one of those, but he has got a fantastic body of work. And you talked about some of the songs that he'd written for other artists. I mean, some you didn't even realize were his songs. When you know they're his songs, you can hear they're his songs, even though he's not singing them. But I don't. Do you know "I Feel for You" by Chaka Khan?
I wouldn't know that now.
You'd know it if you heard it, because it's that kind of famous. But that was like written by Prince for Chaka Khan, and he got Stevie Wonder involved in it. And he got like a whole multitude of artists, but it's a Chaka Khan song. But when you hear it, you can hear, yeah, Prince could have done this. And I think that's the thing. When you hear the songs that he's given to other artists, you can imagine him singing it. And Nothing Compares to You is probably like one of the great songs he's ever written. But you only heard it, you know, fairly recently, actually sung by Prince. It wasn't one that he sung very often live, and I think it might. I think it appeared on a B-side or something. It wasn't a song by him really. You know, it became synonymous with Sinead O'Connor, but his version is different and still just as breathtaking.
Obviously, it's comparing Prince to Sinead O'Connor here, but how would you compare the two versions then? Would you?
They're both incredible songs. They're both incredible versions of the same song, because it is the same song, right? But the tempo and the music behind it are different. So they do sound like completely different songs. And I don't know, I've listened to the Prince version and gone, you know what, I think this is better. But then I'll go back and hear the Sinead O'Connor one and go, no, I think that's better. And it's just a great cover. But the thing is, people didn't realise it was a cover. When Sinead O'Connor released that, they didn't say, oh, this is a cover of Prince song. Because it wasn't known as a Prince song. So that's what's so great about him, is that he made... And I'm sure you're going to start reading off a load of songs that he's released over the years. But, you know, the songs that he didn't record but gave to other people are just as fantastic as the stuff that he did actually do himself, released himself.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's one of those strange things, like, about a lot of successful artists and Prince, you know, probably is one of the best at doing it. But I remember, just on a slight tangent, there was a song by The Killers that was actually given to Rob Williams that I heard of recently. And when you go back and listen to it again, you can go, oh yeah, that would have sounded like a Killers song. And it's just, you do get that kind of odd tidbit. I mean, to be honest, Prince is probably one of the best I've seen. Like I said there before, he estimates at completing between 500 to well over 1,000 songs for other people. I mean, who has that much musical talent that they could write 1,000 songs and then give them to someone else, along with having 39 studio albums yourself?
I mean, it's incredible. There is no musician like him. The day he died, and I remember that year because... that was the same year Burry died, wasn't it? I'm pretty sure Burry died at the beginning of that year, and then he died around the April or May of that year. And both of those deaths devastated me. Prince was the better musician. But I don't know, when it comes to artists, which one's better, I don't know. But, you know, Prince had this incredible body of work, which no one will ever surpass. Although I will say Taylor Swift is giving him a run for his money with the amount of stuff that she's putting out. But it's just incredible. Just the sheer amount of stuff that he's written and recorded. And the other thing as well with Prince that you do see with other artists that, you know, have also been around a long time, is they start to repeat themselves. They start to record stuff that sounds like a rejigged version of another song. You know, they've changed a few words around, or they've changed a couple of chords, but it sounds just like that. Prince was always reinventing himself. And if he wasn't reinventing himself, he was reinventing other artists, you know. And it's, it was a real shame. And I think it was like a Michael Jackson thing, wasn't it? It wasn't he died of a drug overdose, but it was a prescription drug overdose. It was another one of those kind of accidental things where it was the kind of cocktail of the different drugs they were taking killed them. But man, gone far too young. Gone far too young.
Yeah, 57 is not an age that, you know, someone like him or anyone should be passing away. Yeah, it was an accidental fentanyl overdose in a recording studio. Well, look, found at its home and recording studio, sorry.
I mean, yeah, I mean, he was literally always in a recording studio. I think that was one of the things, like, every day he was, like, putting stuff down, as they say in the biz. But see, the time when, and leading up to this concert, right, so do you watch sport?
Yeah.
Okay, do you ever watch, like, the NFL or anything like that?
Bits of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Bits of
it. So it was the first year I ever stayed up and watched a Super Bowl. Was 2004, I think it was 2005. And Prince did the halftime show.
Yeah.
I never really followed American football. I never really followed the Super Bowl halftime show or anything. I knew it was a thing, but I just happened to tune in this one time. And I saw this halftime show. It was the first time I'd ever really seen him perform live properly. And I was like, my God, if he ever comes back to the UK, I need to go and see this person. And the next thing he did was announce this unprecedented residency at the O2. I suppose mainly unprecedented because the O2 was just being opened up as a music venue.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, it's very unusual to have an artist do a residency anywhere, and especially for that kind of period of time outside of Vegas. I think that's the only other kind of place where you see artists do those kind of residencies, but not at a venue like the O2.
So, yeah, so we'll jump back to the residency in a sec. I just wanted to just touch on, because Prince itself, you dip your toe in the water, and I don't know if I mentioned it there, 39 studio albums, over 100 million records sold worldwide, ranked number 27. So do you want to just give me a shout out, and we'll see if they appear on the set list at all? If I name these albums off in years, give me a shout out on any of the albums and a song off that album you might like. A lot of albums to get through, so if you like a song of every single one, you might just want to give that one a miss.
You know what? I will say this now. I will get a load wrong because I'm useless at remembering what tracks came from what album. Like, if you were telling me, I'll list off, like, the best of Prince, and I'll go through the set list there. I'll go, oh, yeah, I know all of those. I'm awful when it comes to albums. I mean, obviously, there are a few obvious exceptions, like Purple Rain. That kind of tells you what's on that album. But, like, I can't remember what You Got the Look, what album that was on for I Was Like, which I do really like as a Prince song. Or even Raspberry Beret. I think that was the first Prince song I fell in love with, was Raspberry Beret. And I can't for life me remember what album it came off of.
Did that not come off the Purple Rain album? No?
It might well have done. I mean, it was certainly around that time that it came out. I want to say like it was like about an 85, maybe 86 release, something like that.
So he started in 1978 with his first album, For You. Then Prince in 79, Dirty Mind in 80... Controversy in 81, 1999 in 82, Purple Rain then came out in 84, 10 years before I was born.
All right, show off.
Around the World in a Day in 85, Parade in 86. So it might have been Around the World in a Day or Parade, that Raspberry Parade.
Yeah, I think now you've said that, it might be Parade. But I've probably just embarrassed myself even more now, so I'll just shut up.
Just get any Prince. I'll be getting like comments left from Prince superfans going, "This guy, you just."
And again, this is exactly why I said I'm a big fan of Prince. I'm not a super fan, because people know those albums inside out. And I think the problem is, especially now, if I'd have grown up with these Prince albums in my collection. Probably would have been CD, by the way, not cassette. We're not all like that. But I probably would have like remembered all this stuff. But, you know, I really kind of started really listening to Prince when I had like an iPod and I was getting music online. So it all kind of like blurs into one, really, which is awful. But another thing that I hate about modern music and the fact that we do have things like your Spotify's and Amazon Music and stuff like that, is you're not listening to albums.
No.
I normally have it on shuffle by mistake. So even if I am listening to an album, I'm not listening to it in the correct order.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? No. Yeah. I think I've had this conversation with Colin before. Albums are dead. The albums are,
And also as well, like if you listen to a proper album, so I'm talking like a Prince album or I mentioned Madonna earlier, she's another good example. When you listen to one of those albums, an album that I did listen to ad nauseum was Like a Virgin. No, not Like a Virgin, Like a Prayer. Slightly later one than that. But that album, which funny enough, Prince is on. So there is a reason for mentioning that album. Prince is on a track on that Like a Prayer album, but it all follows, like every track, not telling a story, But every track kind of goes into the next song, and it works, and there's a kind of theme, and you know, it just works. And nowadays, when I have listened to more recent albums, the majority of more recent albums, it's a collection of songs.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like a mixtape of somebody. There's no rhyme or reason. You put the track you think is going to be the most popular one, or the first single, the first or second nowadays. Before, that would have been like five or six on the album. And yeah, you could listen to it in any order and it wouldn't make any difference. Whilst you go back and listen to albums like A Purple Rain, and it flows.
Yeah. I think there's a few albums that I've listened to in the past 5 years or something which are written to flow like that. But I do agree, it's all about singles now. Because of the likes of Spotify, it's a singles market. That's just how the music industry's gone. Before I do carry on with the albums, I must ask you, because it seems to be a common theme that's coming up on my podcast at the moment, vinyl. Much of you on vinyl.
I used to collect Disney Vinylmations, which are little Mickey Mouse toys, and that's really my involvement in vinyl. I had a few vinyls when I was a kid. CDs, I was born in 83, so I'm 9 years older than you, and CDs were just kind of becoming a bit of a thing, probably by about the age of three for me. I think my dad bought his first CD and bought his first CD player around that kind of age. So we had vinyls, but we weren't really listening to vinyls in the way that you know, some of your previous guests have done. And I have bought a vinyl recently, actually. I bought the Tron Legacy soundtrack on Record Store Day because I love that album. I've got nothing to play on, but I love that album. So I thought I'd buy it in a new version. But I don't know if it's my hearing. I don't know. But I don't really... I can't really hear a difference when I listen to a vinyl recording to when I can listen to a CD recording. I would much rather, and I know you talked about this recently, about the last physical music that you bought, which I know happened to be vinyl, but I'm a big fan of actual buying physical media, because I like feeling like I own something, and I like sleeve notes, and I love artwork, and you know, just having a case. Like, buying a CD was always a joyous experience. Like, you got this amazing artwork to look at, and then you open it up and there's this shiny disc, and then there's a book, and that might have lyrics in, or it might have more art in it, or whatever, but you felt like you got something for your money. And now the same price that I pay for an album on Amazon or iTunes or whatever, I just get a recording. I just get a load of files that I don't actually own. You know, I'm basically renting them on a long-term lease. And I've got nothing to hold.
Yeah, I think it's just people's association with music now has changed, and people's association with how you own music and how you own a product and stuff has changed, hasn't it?
I don't really get the vinyl thing in that you're paying a lot more money for what, in my opinion, doesn't sound any better. Especially more modern music. You know, I get that, you know, recording standards were different in like the 60s and 70s. So there are probably some vinyls that will sound different to how like a CD that's been remastered might well do. But I don't think if I got the new Taylor Swift album, and I keep saying Taylor Swift because Taylor Swift is my daughter's first artist. That's the first person. I mean, she enjoys the music we've played for her. Like, I think the first song I ever heard her sing along to was The Chain by Fleetwood Mac. So, you know, there was some good stuff. But Taylor Swift is like the first artist that she has found herself. And I'll be fair, as someone that always knocked Taylor Swift or the concept or the idea of a Taylor Swift, actually listened to her stuff. She's actually quite good. She's actually quite a good songwriter. But I can't imagine that. If I listen to that on a vinyl compared to listen to it on Amazon Prime Music or whatever, I'm going to hear that much difference. Maybe it's my crappy ears, I don't know.
I'm just going to get slated for this, but hipsters. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where did Reviewbot...
Don't write penny farthings.
Read your penny farthings.
Look, I've seen them in London, right?
I'll give over.
Oh, yeah. If you go to... I've not seen one in Soho, surprisingly, but it's where I'd imagine them to be. But now, if you kind of go down to, like, the Hoxton area, which is another kind of very hipstery part of London now, it's been gentrified, I have seen somebody on a penny farthing and just thought, you're a tosser. Apologies for the language.
We've regressed. As a human race, we're slowly regressing.
Absolutely, 100%, yeah.
My God. I blame Brexit, but hey-ho. moving on, where did we leave off? Parade. Followed by Sign of the Times. He's almost releasing albums on a yearly basis at this stage. So Sign of the Times in 1987, Love Sexy 88, then the Batman album 89, Graffiti Bridge in 1990, Diamonds and Pearls 91, Love Symbol album 92, then they had the contract dispute where he became the artist formerly known as Prince. And then he released Come in 1994, Black album also in 1994 was just a good year just for the world. Yeah. The Golden Experience 1995, Chaos and Disorder 96, Emancipation 96, Crystal Ball 98, The Truth 98, The Vault, Old Friends for Sale 99, Rave Unto the Joy Fantastic 99, The Rainbow Children 2001, One Night Alone 2002, Expectation 2003. Notice that the expectation isn't an EX, it's expectation, just to be a bit edgy. Yep. News in 2003, which is N.E.W.S. Jesus, 2003 was an edgy year. The Chocolate Invasion 2004, The Slaughterhouse 2004, Musicology in 2004. He released three albums in 1 year.
Yeah. I think, if I remember rightly, I think he just signed a new music deal that year. And he was just like, you know what, I'm just going to release a load of albums. That was it. Like, yeah, just like free on the bounce, pretty much.
How do you market that? You can't market it.
Not really.
It doesn't work.
No. No. Completely with you there.
He did give himself a 2-year gap and released 3-1-2-1 in 2006. Planet Earth in 2007, which was part of the tour that you saw. Lotus Flower 2009, MPL Sound 2009, 2010, 2010. Ah, that makes sense. Plectrum Electrum 2014, try saying that after a few points. Artificial Age 2014, Hit and Run Phase 1 2015, Hit and Run Phase 2 in 2015. Then he unfortunately passed away, and he's had two posthumous releases on Piano and the Microphone 1983 to 2018 and Originals 2019. Do you want to just talk for a little bit there? I need to get my breath back.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about Planet Earth was that was released in the UK as a giveaway with a Sunday newspaper. I want to say it was a Sunday Mail, but I can't remember for sure. But basically, that album was given away with copies of that paper that day.
Really?
Yeah. And I think he did something similar with 3121 in the States. So I don't think it was the first time that he'd done that, but it was the first time he'd done it in the UK. And obviously it worked out well because it was, you know, technically the biggest selling album of the year, you know, just because of distribution numbers of the paper. I don't think it was ever officially clarified as that because obviously it wasn't done down the right channels or it wouldn't have been charged at the right price or what have you. But yeah, you know, you paid £1.50 for your Sunday paper or whatever, and you got this cardboard sleeve of a Prince album in it. You know, it was a great way of marketing yourself. And the thing is, it wasn't a bad album. You know, if you, like anyone, when you're releasing that many albums, they're not all classics and not all the tracks are, you know, amazing. But I never listened to, or I've not listened to every album, but I've not listened to Prince album and thought, this is a load of guff. Some are much better than others, granted, but do you know what I mean? Like, sometimes you do listen to artists and think, yeah, this album is just not very good at all. There's nothing redeeming here.
Yeah.
And Emancipation, I remember getting Emancipation. The Gold Experience was the album that I wanted. And I didn't buy it when it first came out. And it was obviously something to do with the contract dispute, but there were quite a few Prince albums that you could not buy for love nor money for years. Unless on the secondary market, of course, but they didn't have like a proper release for a long time. And but I did get Emancipation, and that was a triple CD album.
Oh, right.
And like with anything that's, and I know recently you talked about Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, when you've got, you know, an album with that many tracks, there are going to be some duffers.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to flow properly, but hey ho, you're getting good value for money.
Oh, definitely. Three discs. Yeah, you don't get that anymore.
No. And it must have cost a lot. You know, I think I paid about... Actually, no, I didn't. I was going to say I paid about 15 quid for it. I definitely didn't pay 15 quid for it, but I'm pretty sure that was the price when it came out, was about 15 quid. But most CDs were like 10, 12 quid anyway. So it wasn't even like there was a huge upcharge for it. But yeah. But I did get the Gold Experience later on. I managed to get it on eBay. Before this series of concerts, I think it cost me about 25 quid or 30 quid. It's quite an expensive CD, and I believe it's been re-released now.
Really?
But it's a good album. It's a good album, The Gold Experience. Yeah, it's one of my preferred Prince albums, but I know it probably wouldn't be high on many people's lists. But that, I think with an artist like that, depending on when you got into them or what the album meant at the time to you, or what the songs on that album mean to you, like if they bring back certain memories or whatever, then I get why people have like favorite albums.
Yeah, and I think Prince, whilst not going through such dramatic change in his career, he was almost, I think, like you said before, like a David Bowie kind of thing, where, you know, if you got him to David Bowie through the Ziggy Stardust phase, he was in that kind of era, and you know what I mean? Prince had his kind of sound, but he changed it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there was always a change. There was always something a little bit different, and some stuff would not appeal to you. You know, if you like a Raspberry Beret, you might not like Sexy MF because it's a bit too racy for you or something. Or like 1999, like... That song, I remember really liking that song when I first heard it. But coming up to the millennium, I mean, MTV played it for 2 days straight.
Really?
Yeah, just on a loop. They just had that playing because it was the end of the millennium. So like, yeah, we'll play 1999. And I'm not saying I watched it, because I didn't. Certainly not all day. But, you know, I think with some of the more popular songs, and I know some... super like hardcore Prince fans would say it's about Purple Rain. I think sometimes they become so kind of overplayed, they do lose that kind of enjoyment. But what I would say with Prince is that even with those songs that get really overplayed, and the ones you normally hear on the radio or played in films or whatever, is that when you haven't heard it for a while, which sometimes might take a bit of time, but when you haven't heard it for a while and then you hear it again for the first time in a while, you realise how brilliant it was, you know? Just a great artist. And more importantly, he was also someone that was just completely entertaining.
Yeah.
To see perform. I mean, I've got a few... I haven't seen them for quite a while because most of my DVDs are now kind of like in boxes or whatever, but... I had a few Prince concerts from around the millennium. He released like a few different gigs on DVD and stuff like that. And every gig has got a different set list, got completely different kind of story he was telling in terms of, you know, the reason why he's playing certain songs or what have you. But he just always looked like he was having a good time.
He clearly just loved music. He just loved... He had to have done.
And I've seen, I was thinking before we were recording this tonight, I was thinking about like the bands that I've seen the most times and stuff like that, or just the bands in general. I've seen, you know, through festivals and stuff like lots of bands over the years, and there were certain bands that stick out, but for all the wrong reasons. Like the one of the worst bands I ever saw live was the Lightning Seeds at a festival. It would have been like in the 90s, so the kind of height of their kind of fame, really. But, you know, he trundles on stage and he just stands there singing to a microphone, strumming a guitar, not looking at the audience, not engaging the audience. Just basically, I'm going to play these songs and bugger off. And do you know what I mean? There's no enjoyment in that. I don't care how much you enjoy the music. You want to feel you're a part of something. And if they, you know, if the person you're seeing perform doesn't look like they're enjoying themselves, you can't have a good time. My wife, she went to see such a bad habit. She went to see Razorlight with a friend of hers, and again, this would have been at the height of their fame, so around 2005, 2006. And she said it was awful. She said you just looked like he just did not want to be there. And she said I just could enjoy myself there.
In their defense, don't they have a song saying they want to be anywhere but here?
No, that's the Kaiser Chiefs, who, funnily enough, I think he's the Kaiser Chiefs, isn't it?
Oh my god,
I can't believe it.
No,
hang on. No, you really could be right.
Really wish I could be someone else.
Yeah, like. Yeah. And I liked what you were going for. I've just ruined the joke, but never mind. I actually saw the Kaiser Chiefs perform with Ricky Wilson in a wheelchair in a plaster cast because he'd broken his ankle, and he still ended up jumping around the stage. So yeah, definitely not the Kaiser Chiefs as being boring. But yeah, it's just like I just find that, especially when you're paying money, and I don't care if it's at a festival or you're the support act or it's your headline gig, right? Which the Razorlight one was. It was their gig. People are paying money to see you. And gigs aren't cheap. We're going to talk about is cheap, but gigs in general aren't cheap. You're paying good money to go and see these people, and you want to have a good time. You want to feel like you've got your money's worth.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I get it. People have bad days and whatever, but you're putting on a show. If you went to the West End and you're watching a musical and the whole cast don't want to be there, you're not going to enjoy yourself.
I believe that show is called The Les Miserables. We're all miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how they get their jobs. How miserable can you look? Yeah, that'll do. Very good.
Anyway, moving slightly on from that terrible joke. So Prince announced his 21-night residency in London, and you hit the nail on the head where you don't do residences if it's not in Las Vegas, generally. You know, generally, Vegas is where you go and do your residences. And to this date, the Earth Tour is the longest residency ever to be held at the venue, with a total of 350,000 people being played to over the dates, which commenced on the 1st of August 2007. And concluded on the 21st September 2007. I was actually looking, trying to find some of the set lists before, and there was a few kind of artists who kind of came in and out in between them, so it wasn't a straight run of events, which makes sense because the 1st to the 21st isn't 21 nights.
No,
I've just gone full circle on that. Speaking of going full circle, it was a show played in the round, which means that the stage is in the middle, for anyone who doesn't know it, surrounded by the audience. And an interesting fact on this, which I don't know if you will know or not, but before this residency, the band rehearsed 200 songs, and Prince would use a code word to direct his band to the next song choice to change it on the sly each night.
It comes as no surprise. I didn't know that. But no, you know, I had a friend who went to, I think it was five or six nights, and every night was different. Some songs he'd hear, you know, on subsequent nights, but the set list was always different.
So I find that mad. How do you know 200 songs?
It's incredible. I mean, the one thing about Prince in general, if you look back through history with him, you know, he's never had the same people. He has the same band members for periods of time. Sometimes those could be very short periods of time, but normally, you know, a good few years. And sometimes people like go in and out. It's like his version of the E Street Band, I suppose. But even so, like that's you've got some really talented musicians. And I will say that everyone he had on stage that night, you could see how incredible they were.
Mm.
Like they were outstanding in their field. But to know that many songs and to know what Prince was going to do and to be able to go on the fly with that amount of songs is just ridiculous.
Yeah, no. And then sometimes following the concerts, he would then hold an after party in the Indigo venue, which is a slightly smaller in-house venue. So, like, if you think that the O2 Arena is, what, 20,000 capacity, is it?
I'm not sure. So just to talk about the setup, because
yeah,
the O2 had only been open for a few months. The first concert there, I believe, was Justin Timberlake, and I'm sure my wife went to see Justin Timberlake there on one of the first nights of the O2, and I think he was in the round as well. But the round is very, very rarely used in the O2, and everyone I've ever seen do a concert since has played as you would do in a normal music venue, with the stage yeah, being right at the back. And I absolutely hate the O2. The O2 really? Is the nearest big venue to where I live. You know, it's not that near, but it's very easy for me to get to, probably about an hour and a bit on public transport. But the actual venue itself sucks, because you're so far away from everything. You can be so high up from everything, and it's just not a great place to be. Being in the round was great, because even though your seats may not have been that great because of where he was, they still felt like good seats.
Yeah,
and it sounded better. I think because it was in the middle rather than being right at the other end, and even though they got like obviously like hundreds of speakers or what have you, it sounded better. I've never heard anything sound as good in the O2 as I did with Prince being there. So. But the Indigo... go on.
Sorry, just to talk about the set. Like, I play music and like, whenever I go to a gig, if I ever see something a little bit crazy, I kind of start, my mind starts... We were talking about it actually before we start recording about Disney, and you can't kind of look at the layers of what they have to go through to get to a certain image and certain performance style. And I always find that, like, in the round concerts... It always just boggles my mind of, like, how do they get the artist on and off stage, and how do they smuggle them on? Because I'm assuming, like, we'll obviously get to the actual set itself, but I'm assuming Prince just didn't stroll through the crowd, like, just like, oh, how's it going, lads?
He appeared from under the stage. that's what happened. Yeah, I'll come to that in a bit, actually. But I've been to the Indigo. I've been to the Indigo twice for music events. So have you ever been to the O2?
I've been to the O2, yeah.
Okay.
About 10 years ago.
Yeah, my apologies. But the Indigo is this like little, small, almost like cabaret-like venue, where it's got an upstairs that can be turned into seats. I think you can put seats downstairs, but I've never seen seats downstairs. So you normally have people sitting upstairs, you have standing downstairs, you have a small stage, and... I don't know what the capacity is, maybe 1,500, 2,000 people tops, at a guess, I'd assume. And funny enough, the first act I saw in there was Maceo Parker. I don't know if you know who Maceo Parker is, but he's a saxophonist, and he was one of the saxophonists on the night we saw Prince.
Oh, really?
Part of that band. So... because we enjoyed him, we went to see his solo show. I don't know, maybe I think it was towards the end of that year. It wasn't during the run; it was separate. But I don't think the night we went to see Prince, there was an after party. There wasn't an after party every night, because that's what they called it, or they referred to it as, like, the Prince after party. But can you imagine, you know, playing in the O2 for 2.5 hours, you know, near 3 hours, coming off stage, and then, you know, half an hour later, popping up in the venue next door and singing some more. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was just incredible what he was doing during that time.
Oh, yeah. And even if you did some, even if you look at, like, the Vegas residences and stuff like that, they would never go to that kind of degree of what he did. You know, it was just, it's up there, legendary status, you know. It's
I saw Elton John in Vegas during his Million Dollar Piano residency, and it was great. You know, it was a good show, but, you know, it was a kind of standard concert in a slightly smaller venue than what you'd usually see someone like Elton John. So for that, it was good. But, you know, it was, you know, just over 2 hour set, and off he pops, and then he comes back the next weekend or whatever. You know, it's just not comparable. It really isn't. The second gig I ever saw at the Indigo, though, was Chaz and Dave, which I could have quite easily had the conversation tonight about Chaz and Dave, because they were two of the best live artists I've ever seen. They're very, very talented musicians, but also the atmosphere they brought with it. Like, it's the biggest party I've ever been to. I've seen them a couple of times live, and every time I saw them, it was just like a huge, proper Cockney knees up for 2 hours with two, like, men in their 70s bashing about on pianos. It was, yeah, they were pretty incredible themselves. But, I mean, they don't touch Prince, though, in terms of performance. Schools they were.
I was going to ask, actually, after we went through the set there about some of your favourite gigs that he'd been to and how they compared. Would Chaz and Dave, would they be close? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. In terms of fun, 100%. Like, I've been to quite, when I thought about it, I've actually been to more gigs I've seen more people live than I probably remembered. But yeah, they would definitely be high up on there. I remember I'd seen them at the Indigo at 1 year, and I said to my wife, they're playing nearby to us, we should go. She's like, oh, I don't really fancy it. And she was pregnant at the time. I was going with my parents, and someone pulled out sick. I can't remember if my sister-in-law or someone pulled out sick anyway. So it was a spare ticket. So my wife went along. So my daughter's first ever gig was actually Chaz and Dave. When she was about, you know, 5 months, minus 5 months or something. But yeah, we had a great time there. And then she understood exactly what I loved about it. It was just a good party kind of atmosphere. But they're bloody good musicians. If you ever get round to it, it's probably on YouTube, but the BBC every now and again have a documentary about Chaz and Dave. And they were session musicians before they kind of did their own thing. And they were really, in the music industry, really well-regarded musicians. Like, very in-demand musicians, because they could just play anything.
Yeah.
Really talented guys. And I think because their songs were kind of quite novelty-like, they never got the respect that they should have done, except for people that appreciate music and could see it. But I think we just heard their songs, you go, I had a bit of a novelty act, but they were so much more.
I wouldn't say there was a novelty act, because they're still highly regarded in UK music folklore. Like, you know, it's...
Yeah, I think I mean by the general populace. I think the industry definitely appreciate them.
It's like saying that Madness are a novelty act, because they're, you know, but it's a similar thing, I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a bit comedy, because the songs are not, you know, all soppy love ballads or stuff like that, or big rock anthems. You know, they're not appreciated in the same way. But yeah, I think Man is probably falling into that category as well. But yeah, anyway, let's move back from the Indigo. Let's go back to the O2. So I've got a funny story about how I got tickets for this as well.
Yeah. Actually.
So When I was watching the Super Bowl, and this dates me again, I was chatting to my mate on MSN Messenger, but that's what all the cool kids did back in those days, right? So we're watching the Super Bowl, we're watching Prince, and I said to him, man, when Prince comes over, we're going to have to go and see him, aren't we? He's like, yeah. And so I'm sure it was a 2005 Super Bowl, so it was about early 2007, late 2006, they announced Prince was going to do this residency. And we got tickets. We got four tickets. He had a girlfriend, I had a girlfriend. She's an ex-girlfriend now, she's now my wife. And I was all set to go. And then I bought the tickets. And I said, oh, just give me the money when you've got it. And he kept making excuses. Oh, I haven't got the money. But what he was doing was he was like buying his girlfriend flowers. And he was taking her out for nice meals. I'm like, well, hang on a second. You haven't got money for these tickets, but you've got money to do this. So we had a falling out. And in the end, what he did, I got the money for the tickets, but what he did is he then swapped his tickets with somebody he works with. So we weren't sure when we got there if he was going to be there or not. And it was just these two women sitting next to us that we didn't know. So we realised what had happened. It's all good. We're all friends now, and it's all fine. But it was funny. So we should have gone to this gig with my best mate and his girlfriend at the time. And instead, we just sat next to these two random ladies from his workplace. But we had a great time. It was all good. The other thing with this as well is, and I don't know if you saw this in any of the notes that you had, but although the tour was the Planet Earth tour, or the Earth tour, because the recent album was at that time 3121, that was the price of the tickets.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So all the tickets, except for there were, I think there were like floor seats that were more expensive, or there was like some packages that they did, but the general admission tickets were all 3121. In the round. So again, that made it very kind of affordable for people like my friend who, different friend this was, who wanted to go five or six times to go and see him. Because, you know, paying $31.21 plus a booking fee to go and see Prince, that's a bargain in anyone's book, you know.
Phenomenal.
Especially like it's 2007. You know, at this point, you know, I'm going to gigs and they're costing me almost 50 quid.
Yeah.
And if you go to the O2, so I... obviously, we're living in COVID times, right? But before that, when Elton John announced his farewell tour, my wife had never seen him because I didn't go to Vegas with her. I left her at home because I'm that kind of man. So I said to her, you should see Elton John. She's a big fan of Elton John. I said, you should go and see Elton John. And my daughter started listening to the Rocket Man soundtrack and getting into Elton John that way. So I said to my wife, well, look, I'll buy you tickets, but instead of me going with you, why don't we let our daughter, you know, be her first concert? So that was the plan, and of course, COVID happened, concert's been delayed, so I think it's been rescheduled to the end of this year. We'll see what happens, if that takes place or not, but they've got tickets up in the kind of nosebleeds of the O2, and those tickets, I think, cost me about £70 each.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. No, I've got Elton John booked as well back end of this year.
Yeah.
I agree. It was ridiculous.
Absolutely ridiculous. And I mean, the tickets we had for Prince, we were sat in the middle tier of the O2. So I think that is classed as level two.
And do you know what the thing about the O2 is as well? Is I've obviously got the O2 I've got the O2 at the end of this year for Elton John. But, when I went to see a band called Two Door Cinema Club there.
Yeah.
And I was in the standing section. So, like, I was up at the front of the stage standing. And you look up, when you look up from the standing section, it actually doesn't look that big.
No.
Weird.
It is a little bit, I know what you mean, but what you don't get is you don't understand the angle that you're sat at. So when you're sat at the top, it's quite a steep angle. The middle's not too bad. The middle level's not too bad. And obviously the floor is the floor, so it's fine. But up in levels 3 and 4, which is right at the top, they're at quite a downward facing angle. I don't like it. I'm not great with heights anyway.
I'm not great with heights either.
No,
I best check my ticket from Elton John.
I think if you're level 3, you might be all right. But level 4, where it's like a little bit higher, yeah, it can be a bit rough. But the problem is, although it doesn't seem that high from down below, when you're up there, it's not a good view. I mean, the one thing I will say, like, if you've never seen Elton John before, it doesn't matter what tickets you have, you're seeing Elton John.
Yeah.
And I think it's way more important to do that than to, like, well, I'm not going to go and see Elton John because the tickets aren't that good. Because I did ponder that when I was buying these tickets. Do I want to do this? You know, is this going to be satisfactory to my wife? And I'm like, yeah, she's going to see Elton John. She's going to be in the same room as Elton John. Of course it's going to be worth it.
Yeah.
Even if he looks like a little dot on the stage, she'll look at the big screen and she'll be able to see it's definitely him. You're experiencing the concert, so it'll be fine. But I'm just not a big fan of the O2 as a venue. I don't think the sound is particularly great in there, considering, you know, it's obviously very expensive. It's a nice idea, but I don't think the execution of it is great. If everything was in the round, I think it would be a different conversation I'd be having right now about the O2.
Mm.
And I don't know what Elton John will be doing. You know, he might be playing in the round. I've got no idea. So I can't remember what the seating layout was like. I was just trying to buy tickets. But, it's fine. I've been to worse music venues, but I've also been to places like the Royal Albert Hall. I had probably similar tickets at the Royal Albert Hall to see Ray Davies. And so I was, you know, he was at the other end of the Albert Hall. I'm at the top in the God section. And because of the acoustics in that place, it sounded like he was playing right in front of me.
That's phenomenal.
It is the absolute best venue to watch music. It's not the best venue to watch wrestling because you can actually hear the wrestlers talking in the ring before they say what the next move is going to be. That's a true story. That I actually heard that. But in terms of like musical performance, because of how that has been arranged, it's absolutely perfect. And the O2 is a multi-purpose venue. It's not designed for just music. It's designed for all kinds of things. And therefore, it is just a big concert tent.
Slightly disagree with that, but you can get arenas which sound amazing. You know, it's just how, like say how it's executed. Like anything in the realms of London, it's overpriced and a complete and utter balls up. Sure, look at the Excel. Well,
yeah.
Look at the Excel and the NHS Nightingale. Yeah. Overpriced and a complete balls up. Moving on, we'll move to the actual show because I'll be getting trouble for that comment. I've got a rough set list here in front of me, which was the opening night set list, but obviously a set list doesn't stick with Prince, like over 200 songs here. So do you want to talk me through, rather than me trying to go through a set list, you talk me through what you can remember of the show, what particular songs you can remember him playing, and, you know, talk me down the set, really.
Yeah, it was... I mean, I had to go and find out when I went to see him, because, as you said, like, every set list was different. And I remember looking at the set list of the first night and getting really excited. But to be honest, I never saw a set list in that run that I thought, well, that would have been a bad night. I mean, there were things that I wish I heard that I didn't. So, like, for example, he didn't play Gold. I don't know how many times he played that during that residency. I think it might have only been a handful. So that, you know, as that being one of my favourite songs of his, you know, I was disappointed not to hear that. But at the same time, the night that I went, you know, I heard he started with Little Red Corvette. So it's quite a standard classic for Prince. Raspberry Beret, huge fan of that song. Then he kind of went a bit deeper into the back catalogue. And the thing is, because he's got so many songs, I didn't know everything. But I didn't need to know everything, in a way, because I was just enjoying the whole experience. And I think sometimes when you go and see, if there's an artist that you like and you do know them so well, and bearing in mind, when you normally go and see an artist, they might have had 3, 4, 5 albums, right? Then when they don't play something you want them to, it sticks out more.
Yeah.
With a Prince, or even I've seen Bruce Springsteen a couple of times. There are songs that you want him to play, and he just won't, because he's got so many songs that he could pick from. It's impossible. Unless you're directing him, you're never going to hear every song you want to hear from the artist you're going to see when they've got that kind of longevity. So, you know, there were a few things that I said, like Gold, that I wish that he'd done. But, you know, there was a few of the newer stuff. So, like, Musicology was from... it was from Musicology. I was going to say it's from Very 121. It wasn't. It was from Musicology. he got somebody up... from the audience. I don't know if they were a plant. They were very good, though, to do Play That Funky Music as a cover version. And I think he did that. I know he did that a few times. He did that as a particular cover version, normally got someone up from the audience to sing it. But I believe he also did that with a few other songs as well.
Okay, yeah.
And I mean, because it was Prince, there was lots of costume changes.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't just stay in the same outfit. So what I was saying to you earlier about him disappearing, so that's how, you know, he appeared coming up from the stage. And, you know, at certain parts of the gig, he would just disappear off the stage and pop back up a few minutes later in a new outfit. So not the saxophonist that we went to see, so not Maceo Parker, but another one. And I can't remember what his name is now. It was Mike something. It's going to bug me. But so while Prince did a costume change, he did What a Wonderful World. And it was just nice. Like, I mean, it's obviously not a Prince song and no one was singing over it, but just hearing that, it was just as... The whole thing was good, because it wasn't just Prince being amazing, but it was his band being amazing. So yeah. Everyone got their chance to shine. Do you know what I mean? Like, everyone kind of got like a bit of a solo to do, or a bit where no one was singing, so you could like really get into the drumming or get into the brass section or whatever. Like it was to give everyone their moment to shine, and I think that's really nice to do.
Yeah, especially when you're such a big artist, and like you could probably let your ego take over. If you're Prince, I think if you're someone like Prince, you could be so egotistical and no one would really care. Like,
and it's clearly a perfectionist. You know, getting your band to learn 200 songs, that is the sign of someone who's a perfectionist. This isn't like, well, you know, if you kind of know this one, then great, jam along. This is like, you need to know this stuff.
Yeah.
So you need talented musicians plus their want to do good by him as well. But yeah, so you had a few of the kind of really obvious ones. He did a piano section. So when he came back up on stage after like the next costume change, he then sat on the piano. Not literally on the piano, he sat on the stool in front of the piano and he started playing. You know, he wasn't trying to do like Michelle Pfeiffer or something, but yes, he did that. And he, again, this comes back to not knowing all the stuff that he's done, right? So he started playing How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore, which I knew as a Alicia Keys song.
Oh, right.
Now, I've never heard the Prince version on an album, so it could be an album that I've not listened to or something, or maybe it was a B-side that I just wasn't aware of. But I knew that it was an Alicia Keys song. So when he started playing it, I was like, oh, he's an Alicia Keys cover. No, it's a Prince song. So, you know, again, the stuff that you don't know that he's been involved with. And he did some, like, good songs during that. So he did, like, Diamonds and Pearls there, Black Sweat, Kiss, Purple Rain. And then he ended that with Let's Go Crazy, which I think is a great way to kind of like end the gig. But of course, that's not the end of the gig. That's just the end of like the main set. And he came out and did two encores, short encores though, admittedly. And the first one was Take Me With You and Guitar, which Guitar was the, I don't know if it was the lead single. So I'm not sure if the single actually came out in the UK, but it was certainly like the main song from the Planet Earth album. And it was that to me was like kind of classic Prince. That could have been recorded in the 80s, even though it had just been recorded. It had that kind of like Prince sound to it. And then he ended it with Get on the Boat, And yeah, so yeah, there were a couple of songs that I would like to have heard, but all in all, it was great. And I think just being able to say I was there, I managed to see Prince live, was in itself a success. But I remember us both leaving there and just completely like floating, because you felt like you experienced greatness. You experienced something so kind of unique and wonderful and just unlike anything else. I've never left a concert. I've left lots of concerts, you know, feeling like happy and, you know, oh, wasn't that great or whatever. But I felt that. Plus, I felt I'd seen this god almost, you know, this godlike figure. I don't do religion, but that was the closest to like Christ that I'd ever come to and probably ever will do. He just seemed like he was on a completely different level to anyone else I'd ever seen live. And it's sad that, you know, there are a lot of people who were Prince fans who never got to see him at all. Who at that age, I mean, look, you know, at that age you would have been like, what, early teens? Yeah, you'd have been early teens. You're not going down to the O2 to see Prince unless your parents are dragging you along. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
But, you know, and the thing is as well, like after that, he didn't do many more gigs in the UK. He came over a few times, from what I remember, but he never did anything like this again. And we never got the chance to see him. And a bit like, because David Bowie is the big one that I never got to see live. And, you know, you just think, oh, there'll be a time. I'll be able to see him again. If I don't see him now, I'll be able to see him again. And a lot of people didn't get that chance.
Yeah.
So I do feel, even though, you know, what was it? There was 21 nights and did you say 350,000 people or something across those nights?
358,000 all nights sold out.
Yeah. You know, so the thing is, a lot of, and I mean, all right, and I know some of those would have been repeat people, so it's not 350,000 individuals, but even if you said 300,000 in different people saw Prince during that run, there's still hundreds of thousands of people that would like to have seen him and never got a chance to, and now never will.
Yeah.
So I do feel very privileged too. And yeah, I get he was around a long time and lots, you know, there was a lot of time for some people to go and see him. So if you didn't see him, that's on you. But it just felt like greatness, and I just can't imagine ever seeing anyone like that ever again.
I get what you mean with that though. I think particularly we touched on the Elton John kind of thing there. I'm in the similar situation where I've put so many artists off and said I'll see him next time, and I thought that Elton John, well, obviously, it was always going to be his goodbye tour anyway. He's hopefully not going to pop his clogs, you know, anytime soon. But, yeah,
I'm sure there's about
many people who probably were gone to Prince and gone, yeah, I'll see him next time he's come over.
Yep.
And, unfortunately, 57 is not an old man. He could have had many years of touring left in him.
He would have been perfect for Vegas residency. I think he dabbled a little bit with that at times, where he did do some runs in Vegas, but never at the kind of Celine Dion, Elton John, kind of Tom Jones levels of, you know, consistency doing it. You know, they did it for many years and what have you. But he is someone that I think, as his career would have been winding down, would have been quite happy doing that. And the thing is, like, we know this is not the last we're going to see of Elton John. Right, this is his farewell tour. And I explained this to my wife. It's his farewell tour. It's not his last ever gig. It's just his farewell tour. He will still do gigs, I'm sure. He'll get to an age where he doesn't want to, but you've still got people like Paul McCartney, who are slightly older than him, still doing gigs. So I think you'll still see the odd thing from him. But you've got to take your chance now. And this is to anybody listening now. Right, if there are artists that you like who, you know, I'm not talking like your Taylor Swift necessarily or your Biebers or whatever else young kids listen to nowadays, but you're more kind of at your older artists, if they're touring, go and see them, because you never know when you're not going to be able to.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So just do it. And yeah, Elton John tickets, bloody expensive. We saw Fleetwood Mac, not the last tour, but the last tour they did all together. So I think that was probably about 4 or 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
When it was like the original 70s lineup. And we went to see them because we didn't know if they were ever gonna tour again or if it was gonna be the full lineup. And sure enough, I think they toured about 2 years afterwards without Lindsay and without Christine as well. So we got to see at this moment, until they maybe get back together again, the last time Fleetwood Mac, the proper Fleetwood Mac, were together. So you know, if you get the opportunity to, just don't worry about the price, because if you miss them, no amount of money is going to make you see them. So yeah, go for it.
And we're speaking obviously about his how he could have done a residency in Vegas and stuff like that. Are you still there?
Yes.
Sorry, I clicked you off then for some reason because I was flicking between my notes.
My dog did his usual thing of starting to tap dance while he was talking, so I muted myself.
Yeah, I thought I'd clicked you off then by accident. Did you at times feel like that, not that you was in Vegas, but like obviously Prince is this, I see the Princess as like Vegas pizzazz, even though it's not Vegas, but it's American pizzazz. Did you feel like you could have been at a Vegas residency through everything that was going on? Like,
yeah, I guess so. But then, if you'd asked me at the time, I'd have said yes. Now I'd say no. But that's only because I've now seen some of those Vegas residencies. So I saw Elton John and I went to see... And this is to a point. I went to see David Copperfield, the magician.
Mm.
But he shares that venue with Tom Jones. So, he'll be there so many weeks of the year, and then it's Tom Jones the rest of the weeks of the year, and, you know, whatever. And it was a really small venue. So the thing with these Vegas residencies... And, you know, Britney Spears obviously done one. Gwen Stefani's one that I'd like to go and see, actually, because I like Gwen Stefani. But these are all really small, kind of intimate concerts.
Okay.
To. So, but at the same time saying that, because it was in the round, it did make the O2 feel much smaller than it normally would be.
Yeah.
So it's probably the closest to a Vegas residency in terms of how it was done and for the length of time and also the setup of the venue as you're likely going to get. And I know some artists have done like a lot of dates at the O2 during a run. So they might have done like 5-7 nights or whatever, but it's not the same. That's not a proper residency to me. I mean, I'm not sure how many dates Elton John's doing at the O2, but I think he's doing quite a few, isn't he?
I think he's doing 8.
I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not to be sniffed at. If you can sell out the O2 8 times during, you know, a couple of week period, that's a big achievement. But he's still not 21 nights, plus, you know, various nights of after parties in the Indigo next door as well. So... yeah, I just can't see anyone coming up at the moment. In fact, I can't see anyone living right now that even has that kind of career that would be able to do what Prince did at that time. I think it was the right venue at the right time with the right person.
Yeah, and I think you were saying there that you was close to greatness. You've seen someone who could almost be religious, who was that great. I don't think we'll ever see that kind of artist again. I don't think we'll ever see kind of a Prince or a Bowie, you know, or, you know, anything like that, where someone is just so good, so legendary. It's just not going to happen anymore.
And the thing with Bowie, from what I could kind of say, is a lot of the things, like when he did tours, like he was the first kind of artists do those kind of really big flashy stadium things. So, you know, like with like the big props, like he did the, was it the Glass Spider or the Metal Spider tour? It was Glass Spider, but either way, you know, like these big props on stage that kind of interacted and, you know, added to the whole concert experience. I saw, and don't judge me on this because it was a free ticket, I went to see Katy Perry at the O2 and she had some ridiculously elaborate set that made it kind of look like some kind of Candyland or something with giant, like, fiberglass lollipops, and there was a cloud that she sat on that floated out above the audience and all this kind of stuff. And that's all great and it's a good experience, but it's kind of hiding the talent, or it's disguising the lack of talent in some ways. Prince didn't need that. The gimmick Prince had that night was he had a stage in the middle of the O2 that was shaped like the love symbol. And that was as gimmicky as it got. You know, I don't really consider costume changes as being gimmicky. But do you know what I mean? The rest of it was about the music and the performance. You know, there was nothing else other than that. He didn't need props.
Yeah. And why would he? It's a guitar does the talking for him.
Yeah.
Well, he does the talking for him, even. I'll just check there before we round up, actually. Just check there then. The longest residency other than Prince was Take That in 2015, who performed 10 nights.
Oh. It's another band I've seen, actually. I saw them on their first reunion tour in, I don't know, 2006, I think it might have been. I remember there being a football tournament on at the time because before the day of, like on the day of the gig, the England game was before the concert was due to start, so they played that on the big screens because they had to, basically. There was going to be too many men being dragged along by wives and girlfriends for that not to have happened. And I believe it was when England lost to Germany, if I'm remembering. It must have been the Euros. South Africa. Oh, yeah, of course, yeah, 2010, wasn't it? Yeah, so, it was then anyway, but... yeah, I mean, again, they were fine. But that's it. I think the problem is when you see someone like that, and I've seen a few really good artists, but when you see a really good artist, when you then go and see something else, you can say, yeah, it was entertaining or they did a good job. But, and to, unfortunately, to paraphrase a Prince song, like, nothing compares. You know, it just doesn't. It just physically can't. Compared to that, when you see someone that like majestic, everything else kind of, and I've had great concert experiences, but it was the complete package that, and I wish I remembered more of it. That's the thing. As you kind of get older, you know, there's still parts of that concert I remember really vividly, but do I remember the whole, you know, 2¾ hours or so that he was on stage for? No. But what I remember was just amazing.
It is all about those individual memories, though. You know, those memories, it's what I call memories of a lifetime, you know, because when you're old and retired, you'll still be telling people of the time that you saw Purple Rain, the O2, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I know we kind of touched on it, Chaz and Dave, being up there, but kind of... Does anything else get close to Prince, or was that kind of the pinnacle for you?
There's one concert that is, I mean, in some regards, seeing someone like Prince is kind of like, there is a concert that I really would like to have talked, I should have talked about really in some ways, but it probably wouldn't have made such a good story or so long. But there is one concert that absolutely defines my life. And that is probably the most important concert of my life. It's not the best performance. That's definitely still with Prince. But it is the most important concert of my life. So it was the 22nd of November 2004. And it was a band called NERD. Now, have you heard of NERD?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so it is NERD, but with little asterisks in between each letter. And it stands for No One Ever Replies.
Oh, NERD is in Pharrell Williams and...
Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
What I might do, Nick, actually, is I feel like this is one not to cut you off, but I might put a pin in this, and we'll have a double header here, and we'll have you on next week or the week after, whenever you get time to talk to me again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll dedicate it, because I feel like that needs a whole episode on it if it's got such big memories on it. I don't want to cram in it and have you cramming all this in at the end of an episode. And
then... Yeah, I'd say this is such a good cliffhanger. Well, it either is or isn't. Your audience has either got really bored of me by now, just going on, why does he keep whittling on about Prince? Yeah, okay, we get it. It was good. But yeah, if you're not sick of me, I mean, I can tell you now, it won't be as long as this. It definitely won't be as long as this, but it is clearly the most important concert of my life. And that's all I will say on it to leave your listeners wanting hopefully more from me. So yeah, thank you, Jamie, for doing that.
We'll pick up part two in the next few weeks. But for now, thank you very much for joining me and sharing your story about seeing Prince, absolute iconic legend in the music industry, you know, gone too soon.
Oh, sorry, I thought when you said iconic legend, I thought you was referring to me. That's a blow to the ego.
Ah, Nick, no. We know you're a podcasting legend. We don't need to be blowing more smoke up your ass.
Absolutely not.
So go and listen to any of Nick's podcasts on the After Dark Network, the DLP, the Discover DLP podcast, This Is Your Life. What else did I miss there, Nick?
Disney Parks and Beyond, that Universal podcast, and there's more, but I'm not going to talk about them now.
Just pick up any of the After Dark podcasts, After Dark Network podcasts, and 9 times out of 10, you'll probably find Nick lurking around there somewhere.
I basically invite myself on all of them if I can do. I'm just an egotist.
So thanks very much for joining me. We'll speak again soon. Please do a review wherever you listen to this, and we want your stories too. So contact us at pitsandgigs@gmail.com or any of our socials at Peaks and Digs Podcast. As per usual, we never say goodbye, we just say...
This podcast is part of the After Dark Podcast Network.